usual, and we bring with us the love and greetings of Ruth and Vincent up there and upstate.
This was a talk given by Brother A.E. Fry on conquering the cities of Jericho and Ai. I missed part of the first part of it. Sorry.
Israel. He says, speak not in mine heart. After that the Lord thy God hath cast them out from before thee, saying, for my righteousness the Lord hath brought me into possession of this land. But it was for the wickedness of those nations the Lord doth before thee, not for thy righteousness or for thy uprightness, nor dost thou go to possess their land, but for the wickedness of these nations the Lord thy God doth drive them out from before thee, and that he may perform the word which the Lord sware unto the fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now you will note there, dear friends, that Israel is specifically warned against the thought that they are holier and better than all the other nations. The only reason that they were going into that land was because of the fact that the exceeding sinfulness of these nations that were occupying the land had reached the height where God was now going to execute his judgments. And in order to execute his judgments, he was sending the nation of Israel in there to dispossess them. And if they were faithful in dispossessing those people, then they might inherit the land and take it as their inheritance from God. And they would find it a land of milk and honey. They would find therein peace and rest. But you remember the Apostle Paul says that they did not inherit it as peace and rest. That's because of the fact that they compromised. They didn't do what God told them to do. They were to drive out the inhabitants of the land. And this they failed to do. Now we say, dear friends, that there is the lesson here for us, too, that we might glory in the fact that God has given to us a Jericho, an Ai, a land of promise, the consecrated state or condition of heart. But remember this, dear friends, it wasn't because of the fact that we were better than others that God gave us this, but rather because God was so filled up with the exceeding sinfulness of sin in the hearts of humankind that he was going to make an end of the body of sin. And the body of sin is sin as an organization, with Satan at his head, and all those among humankind and any others that might be alive with Satan, constituting the body of sin. And so, the Apostle Paul tells us in Romans the 6th chapter, knowing this, that our old man is crucified with him, that the body of sin might be destroyed. In other words, why was your old man crucified with Christ? That the body of sin might be destroyed. Now that's just exactly what we have in the typical experiences of Israel. In other words, they were to go into the land of Canaan. They were to destroy and utterly root out all that was inimical to God and his cause. And in faithfulness, they would possess the land in peace and rest. So, since God intends to use us to make an end of the body of sin, he said, I'm going to let you stop right in with your own hearts. There's no use you trying to put an end to the body of sin during the millennial age if you've not been faithful over what I have now given you to do. You have in this land of Canaan, Canaanites, who must be destroyed, who must be put out. This wickedness that dwells in the human heart, I want to be destroyed. And that's the mission that God has given to you and to me. Now you see, Paul says, our old man is crucified with him. Well, now, dear friends, there is a sense in which the old unjustified man was crucified when Jesus was crucified on the cross. Basically, of course, that was to destroy the body of sin. But, dear friends, that's not all of it. There is a sense in which we have been crucified together with Christ for the destruction of the body of sin. Now, not merely Jesus alone, but we are crucified with him for this specific purpose. And that does not then refer to the old unjustified man. It refers to the justified humanity. It refers to a consecration in which a perfect sacrifice is dedicated to God. Certainly the old unjustified man never could have been this. Jesus, as a perfect man, he could offer himself as a living sacrifice to God. He could do that. But how could you and I do it? Only if we ourselves had first received the justification which is by faith in the merits of Jesus' sacrifice. And so having this imputed to us, we, like Jesus, have a perfect humanity that we lay down. Actually, we don't possess it. It's what would be ours at the end of the millennial age. So what we're doing is laying down our just human rights, our restitution rights, and privileges. These are the things we're laying down. For what purpose? So that we might be identified with Jesus, being baptized into his death, and experiencing the power of his resurrection, having a fellowship in his sufferings, being made conformable unto his death. And mind you, that death was a consecration to Jehovah God. It isn't so much that Jesus came to be a sin offering. That is true enough in itself. But Jesus himself declared when he came to Jehovah, and he said, sacrifices and offerings for sin thou wouldst not. In other words, God wasn't looking for sin offerings. That's not what he took pleasure in. They had to be, but those weren't the things that pleased him. And he said to Israel of old, I've not found fault with you for lack of the sacrifices upon your altars. They've always been there. And he said, even if I had been hungry, I wouldn't have told you, because the cattle on a thousand hills, all of these things belong to me. In the 50th Psalm, he says, hear, O my people, I will speak, O Israel, I will testify against thee. I am God, even thy God. I will not reprove thee for thy sacrifices or thy burnt offerings, to have been continually before me. I will not take a bullock out of thine house, nor he goes out of thy folds. For every beast of the forest is mine, and the cattle upon a thousand hills. I know all the fowls of the mountains, and the wild beasts of the field are mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell thee. For the world is mine, and the fullness thereof. Will I eat the flesh of bulls, drink the blood of goats? And then he says, offer unto God thanksgiving, and pay thy vows unto the Most High. So you see, dear friends, these sacrifices which Israel was bringing year after year were sin offerings. Surely they were upon the altars. God demanded that. His justice demanded an offering for sin. But there was no pleasure in it for God. God didn't see anything there that represented the consecration of an individual to the will of God. He saw sacrifices brought because of sins of the individual. So that when Jesus comes, he says sacrifices and offerings for sin you didn't want. You had no pleasure in those things. But I come, as in the volume of the book it is written of me, to give what you do want. And that's obedience. I've come to do your will. Now that, of course, is the consecration of the individual to do the will of God. Now you can go all through the Old Testament scriptures, and you will never find where a sin or a trespass offering has ever been called a sweet savor. There is no sweet savor to the sacrifices brought for sin. But the sweet savor is always identified with the burnt offering, the peace offering, and these offerings which represent the individual as dedicating himself to the will of God. And no one could bring a peace offering unless there had been sin atonement for them. Where the three sacrifices were offered, the sin offering was first, the burnt offering was second, and the peace offering was last. Peace was established only with the individual after atonement had been accomplished for him. So you see, dear friends, that the sacrifices which God takes pleasure in are the sweet savor sacrifices. And these are the ones that are yielded to God by a broken and contrite heart, by one who realizes his inability to live up to all that is the beautiful standard of God, and finds himself continually coming short of such as these. Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, "Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted." The time will come when you'll no longer be hampered with this old body of the flesh, but you'll have a perfect body, and you'll be able to glorify God perfectly and acceptably. Now we say then, dear friends, that this consecration, which is unto death, is that which was pictured in the city of Jericho. Jericho means a constant odor, and let's say a sweet savor. That's what Jericho means. And if your consecration and mine are completely dedicated, as was the city of Jericho, then it will be a sweet savor. Now let's look at the picture a moment and see how the city was dedicated. God said the city was to be destroyed, and only the precious metals and the iron and copper and so forth, these were to be taken, transferred to the Lord's treasury to be used in due time in connection with his temple. So you see, dear friends, here we have a picture of that consecration of an individual, the justified individual, to the will of God, by which will all that is of the flesh is destroyed, and that which has spiritual value is transferred to the treasury of God to be used eventually in the erection of that grand and glorious temple of God in which he shall forever dwell by his Spirit. I trust you're able to follow these thoughts that we're suggesting. And that's why it was that God declared that insofar as Jericho was concerned, there wasn't anything in it that would belong to Israel. So when you dedicate, and when I dedicate ourselves to God, it will be the same as was Jesus' dedication. There is nothing in it for you and for me. It means the utter destruction of the flesh. And it also means that that which has spiritual value or import is saved for God's ultimate purpose, the erection of the spiritual temple of God, which temple someday shall be among men and be the means through which the blessing and favor of God shall reach the people. Now you remember, dear friends, that there was one of the Israelites by the name of Achan. He was a general in the army of Israel, and he appropriated to himself a Babylonish garment and also some of the precious metal which he carried under his tent. Well now, dear friends, you remember when the Israelites went to attack the second city in the promised land, Ai, that they were repulsed, and they suffered the loss of 36 people. They had sent spies up there, and the spies came back and said, "Oh, you don't need any more than 2,000 or 3,000 people to conquer that city. It's just a small city. It isn't anything like Jericho. We can push that right over. Just 2,000 or 3,000 is sufficient." And of course, you remember how the Ai's stayed within the city walls as the Israelites marched up to the gates of the city. And when they got to the very gates, then the Ai's came out and they drove those Israelites back. They lost 36 lives. But they might have been annihilated because Israel's backbone was like water. It wouldn't support the nation any longer. And there they lay before God prosper. And so what did Joshua do? He fell on his face and he prayed to God. And God said, the trouble isn't with me, Joshua. The trouble is with Israel. Someone has appropriated what belonged to me. Dear friends, in the conquering of this great Canaan which God has given to you, to be a place in which you're going to have peace and rest, you've got to be faithful to that covenant with God. He says, gather together unto me my saints, those who have made a covenant with me by sacrifice. And so you see, dear friends, it's going to cost you something. It isn't the case of giving out of the abundance of what you possess. It means giving your very all. You remember that little widow that put two mites in the treasury of the temple, and Jesus seeing her said she's given more than they all. There must have been Pharisees that had given a great deal more than that from a monetary viewpoint. But Jesus said she'd given in all the living she had. And that's what consecration should be to you and to me. We're giving all the living we have into the treasury of the temple of God. That's what consecration really means. Now you see, dear friends, if we're not faithful in that consecration, and we appropriate to ourselves some of our time, some of our money, some of our talent, what are we doing? We're robbing God of what belongs to Him. We have no right to any of these things. They're His. And He's decided to want us to be done with them. And if we're not victorious in our battle over the weaknesses of the flesh, the reason probably is that we have been unfaithful in our consecration, having appropriated to ourselves things which belong to God. Now then, dear friends, the city of Ai. The city of Ai was very close to two other cities, Bethel, which means the house of God, and Bethlehem, which means the house of vanity. Only a step between the sublime and the ridiculous. This is the way God's word puts it. Ai means crooked. And in our little Canaan cities here, there's much that is crooked. There's much that is lame. There's much that is warped. There's much that is biased. And if we would have the victory over it, the crookedness that lies within, we can only have it by being faithful in our covenant of consecration to God. You wonder why this didn't turn out that way. You wonder why that didn't turn out the way this did. You're disappointed. But your disappointment traces back not to God's unfaithfulness. He that promised is faithful. Great is thy faithfulness. But if there's any disappointment, it originates from our own unfaithfulness. Now, in order to conquer the city of Ai, you know what was necessary. In the first place, they made only a half-hearted endeavor when they sent only 2,000 or 3,000 men against the city. After Achan had been taken to task and paid the supreme sacrifice for the sin that he had committed, not only against God, but against the nation that he was identified with, God then instructed Joshua, and he says, fear not. He needn't fear now because God was now with him. But he says, I want you to take all the men of war. You see, dear friends, the trouble with you and with me sometimes is we've got a little weakness. We've got something that's a little crooked in here. We equivocate. We give answers that are not exactly true. They're true enough in themselves. But we give the answer in such a way as to mislead someone else to believe something quite different from what the actual truth is. Of course, you've said the truth. Literally, you've been very honest about it. Nevertheless, in the truth which you have suppressed, you've been dishonest. You know, there was a lady that came to her minister once, and she says, just because I wanted to do God's will, do the thing that was right, I've been very, very much abused by one of the members of the congregation. And so the pastor said to her, well, Millie, what did you say to so-and-so? Well, she said, I told her that if she wasn't very careful about her daughter, that she'd be getting into trouble, and this and that, everybody was talking about it already. And she said, because I told her that, why, she didn't like it, and she just fired back at me. Well, he says, did you tell the whole truth? Says, you said you told the truth. Oh, she said, yes, I told the whole truth. And the pastor says, well, that was wonderful that you did tell the whole truth. Generally, only God is the one who can tell that. But tell us, what else did you say? No, that's all I said. Well, he says, that isn't all the truth. Did you tell her what a good girl, how talented she was, how beautiful she was in character otherwise, and so forth? Did you make any mention of the good things? No, of course you didn't. So you didn't tell all the truth, you say. And that's the way we do sometimes. We only say a part of the truth. And the result is that people come to erroneous conclusions because we have equivocated. That's the trouble. That's where the crookedness lies, you see. And we sometimes feel, when we recognize that we've got something in our hearts that shouldn't be there, we feel that, oh well, it won't take much of an effort, we can throw that off easily. And what do? We make a half-hearted endeavor, and all of a sudden, we land in defeat. Just as the Israelites did at their first attempt to conquer the city of Ai. Then God says, I want you to take all the men. Never underestimate your enemy. It is true that greater is he that can be for you than all that can be against you. But notice I says, greater is he that can be for you. He isn't always for you, because you're not in the place where his blessing and favor can come to you. The cobbler that prepares the shoes down there in the basement, he never sees the sunshine. He's pallid, he's pale, and he doesn't feel too good. He knows that the sun is good, and there's lots of vitamin D there, and they're doing the world of good to get a little fresh air. The fact that he knows these things doesn't make it any different. You've got to go out where you can get the sunshine, and if you go where it is, you're going to get the benefit of it. You're going to be getting the blessing and favor of God. He'll be for you if you are where you should be so that you could get his blessing. There was a young lady one time, she was one of these youthful Christians, you know, and she didn't see any wrong in dancing. She went to her pastor and she said, Pastor, is there anything wrong? Can I be a Christian and dance too? Well, he said, what do you think? And she said, well, I think I can. Well, he said, attend it. Go ahead, try it. So she went to the dance hall and she met a nice young gentleman there and were dancing around. In the course of her conversation, she wanted to give a testimony that she was a Christian. And he said to her, you're a Christian? Then what are you doing here? And with that, of course, she got her rebuke and she went back and told her pastor. She now knew that she could be the same kind of a Christian as she wanted to be, and still do the things that the world does. No wrong in those things, of course, except the consecrated child of God can't do them. And so you see, dear friends, sometimes we underestimate our enemies and the forces that can be against us. And we make a half-hearted attempt, and even with all that you've got, you still fail. Unless God is for you too. But God isn't going to defend you unless you use all that you've got. Now, you see, dear friends, that changes the picture. Just a little strength may be all that you have. Yet if God is with you, your victory is complete. But if you had all the strength in the world, you'd still not be victorious. You know, there are good things that you may seek to do without God. They're going to fail, even though they are good. But if God is with you, the victory is yours. So God said to the nation of Israel through Joshua, I want you to build up an ambush behind the city. Now I want you to come up before the city. That's the same as it did before. And the Gaites are not coming out after you until you reach the gates of the city as they did the last time. Then I want you to turn back and run as though you were fleeing for your life. And with that, the Gaites will come rushing out of the city behind you, thinking they have vanquished you. And with that, the ambush behind the city comes in, burns the city, and then Joshua gives the signal, and the Israelites turn about upon their enemies. And the enemies, seeing their city destroyed by fire, are already weakened by the thought that they have no place to return to. And thus, they were not only conquered, but vanquished as well. Now you see, dear friends, the trouble with you and with me sometimes is that we get that wickedness out. But we don't see that there's no room for it to get back in there again. We leave the door open. The same as Balaam did when these people came from Balak and said, we want you to curse these people that have come up out of Egypt there. We want you to curse them, and we'll give you honor and glory. Well, that should have been enough for a prophet that knew Jehovah God. But what did he do? He said, oh, just come in here and make yourselves comfortable. Stay here overnight, and I'll see what the Lord has to say about it. You see, instead of saying, be gone, slamming the door and putting in the bolt, he left the door open. And you know, when he told them that he wouldn't go, he didn't tell them all. He just suppressed a part of the truth. And by the time the message got back to Balak, instead of it appearing to Balak that Jehovah God would not allow Balaam to curse the Israelites, it appeared as though Balaam didn't feel he was getting enough for doing the job. And so the king says, well, I'll give him more gold than I promised him before. And so those messengers went back, you remember, to Balaam. Did Balaam slam the door in their faces? No, he says, come right in. And they came in again. He said, I'll see what the Lord has to say about it. And you know what happened? The Lord came to Balaam during the night and he said, I don't want you to go. But if you do, if they do come to you in the morning and they ask you to go along with them, then you go. But you just say what I've told you to say. You know, Balaam couldn't sleep that night. He was the first one up. He didn't wait for them to come to him and say, well, we want you to come along. No, he was all ready to go. You see, dear friends, if you don't slam the door in the enemy's face, he's coming in. It's going to be harder for you to get rid of him later on. That's the way it is with AI. There are crooked things in there. And if you put them out, see that you've got something else you can put in their place, make sure that they're destroyed and they don't have a place to come back to. And I say sometimes the people of this generation, the world, are wiser than the children of light. I had an old boss, Mr. Hopkins. He was an inveterate smoker. I could hear him cough two blocks away, and I knew it was he. Well, sometimes he tried to give up smoking. He was a Roman Catholic, and when Lent came around, he'd sometimes say, well, I'm going to just practice a little self-denial. I'm going to give up smoking for Lent. He'd go one day, and then he would be back at it again. Couldn't stop it. Until one time, he lost about 32 pounds in a very short 2 weeks. He went to the doctor, and the doctor said, Mr. Hopkins, you may never come to me again, but you've got nicotine in your system, and that's what's doing the damage. He said, you have to stop smoking. Mr. Hopkins stopped smoking for a month. He went back to the doctor, and the doctor says, I'm sorry, it's still there. Come back again in 3 weeks. In 3 weeks, he came back. And the doctor says, all right now, Mr. Hopkins, you may smoke again, but only 2 cigarettes a day. And Mr. Hopkins said, oh, no. He says, I've tried for years to stop smoking. But he says, now I've stopped, and I'm not going to start again. But you know what he did? In his desk drawer, and I could see him almost every few minutes, he'd open the desk drawer and take out a little piece of chocolate, and he'd chew on that. Then after a while, he'd feel like smoking again, draw it open, he'd put in another little piece. You see what he was doing? He built up an ambush. That smoking habit couldn't go in there while the candy was in his mouth, you see? And so it must be with us. The AIs, those crooked things that dwell within, you get them out for a little while, yes. But how long are they going to stay out when they can come back again? You've got to destroy them. You've got to make sure that the place where they were is occupied by something else, that they can't come back to it. So you see here, friends, that the city of Ai represents that same consecrated condition of heart. In fact, Jericho and Ai were cities that represented all the land of Canaan. And Canaan was typical of the consecrated condition of heart that God says is yours. I want you to go into that consecrated heart of yours. I want you to utterly destroy the Canaanite that dwells in there. Drive them out. I'll drive them out before you. Yes, I'll do that. But you'll have to march into the city so it appears that you are the victors. But in the ultimate, I am the victor. In other words, when you think you've had a victory over the flesh, it's not you who have had it. It's the Spirit of God that had it. But the Spirit of God will not take that victory without your fullest cooperation. And all that you've got, not only 2,000 or 3,000, but all the men of war, so that you don't underestimate any of those little weaknesses and frailties of the flesh that go up to make your Canaan. Now you see, dear friends, if you get those things out, you're going to have a certain peace of mind. The reason that you don't have a peace of mind now that surpasses all human understanding is because there are things in your heart. In my flesh, says the Apostle Paul, that dwelleth no good thing. Sometimes the way we act, we think there was something worthwhile in us. We want other people to think well of us too. Yes, we want them to think well of us too, but we know right well that we don't think so well of ourselves. Have you ever been to a testimony meeting? Some dear saint gets up and just tells you what miserable sinners they are. Well, you wonder why they say such things. But didn't the Apostle Paul call himself the chiefest of sinners? When you get to the place where the Spirit of God really dwells within you, you'll say that Paul was mistaken, that he was the chiefest of sinners, that you are. The story is told about a young woman who read a book one time, and after having read the book, she said, that's the driest thing I've ever read. How a man could sit down and write a story like that, I never understand. I don't see how that thing could sell. But by some sheer accident, she got to know the man that wrote the book. She fell in love with that man. And after she fell in love with the man, she read the story again. She said, that's the most beautiful story that was ever written. The book hadn't changed. The man hadn't changed. What changed? She changed. And so, dear friends, it'll have to be with you and with me. Some of these things that dwell within, we don't see in their proper light. They've been so long with us. They're like the Gibeonites. They beguile us. Sometimes we have a talent. It may be for music. It may be for art. It may be for something else. It was ours when the Lord called us. that we think because we still have the talent that the Lord wants us to use it. Well, I'm going to give you a true little story. We knew a sister many, many years ago. She was in the truth and consecrated. Gave all the evidence of the spirit of the devil. She was very talented. She could play any piece that she would set before her. She'd see it only once. And she'd sit right down and play it exactly as it should be played. She could sing the hymns and play. And as you heard her sing, and with a whole heart in the music, it was so angelic that it would put you in the proper frame of mind for the services that would follow. Well, that girl felt she had that talent and wanted to sing to the praise of the Lord. I don't think the Lord wanted her to use the talent, but she thought he did. So she went into the nominal church. She sang in the nominal church, and there she met a young man who also sang, not because he had any use for religion. We spoke to him and we knew that he was an agnostic, a free thinker. He had no use for the truth at all. Little by little, she withdrew herself from the services. Didn't come anymore. Did you know the reason? Because she had something that it was a part of her dedication to the Lord and should have been left upon the altar. And not until the Lord himself would indicate, I want you to use that talent, he would have given her the place to use that talent. But the adversary, he knows our weaknesses. And because he knows these weaknesses, what does he do? He attacks us in the most vulnerable part. He knows them better than you or I do. Is there something that you've got that you feel you want to use in the service of God? Are you sure that he wants you to use it? If not, you'll find that you'll be beguiled. And as long as you live, you have Gibeonites, Kenites dwelling among you. They may be hewers of wood and drawers of water, but they're not Israelites. They don't belong to the commonwealth of Israel, and you will be clayed by a thorn in the flesh. So the thought, dear friends, of Jericho and Ai is a consecration which is so complete, which allows nothing for you, but all for God. There was a difference between Jericho and Ai. In Jericho, God didn't allow the Israelites to have anything. But in the city of Ai, he allowed them to appropriate some of the spoils to themselves. So after you give to the Lord, he may give you back and let you have your Isaac back. As Abraham offered up his Isaac upon the altar, he was faithful. He would have slain him, but for the angel. And then he received back his Isaac as though from the dead, as though he'd been resurrected. So if you consecrate and dedicate your all to the Lord and you show him that it's completely his, then perhaps the time will come when he will give you back your Isaac, and you can use it to the honor and glory of God and for the blessing of his family. May God bless that to you.
Thank you.